Welcome to your, we are now the Senate Committee on Elections and Ethics. Do you want to do a welcome as well? Do you want to gavel in?
Yeah, and I'll open the afternoon meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. We're meeting jointly today.
Thank you. And we appreciate everybody being here today. I understand that there are a number of folks in the audience who would like to testify this afternoon. We do not have a public hearing scheduled, but we're going to try and get as many folks on as possible, so we would ask you to keep your marks really brief. Since we don't have a sense, I'm guessing 2 to 3 minutes, and I suspect we can get folks on. Promise King, who's here from the Oregon League of Minority Voters, is running late. So I'm going to go ahead and bring up Alex Aronson from the Bus Project. Is Joanne's probably with Promise. And is Francisco Lopez here? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and get started with Mr. Aronson. Welcome. And why don't you tell us who you are and want to hear what your suggestions are.
Hello, Madams. How do I do this? Madams Chair, members of the committees.
Great.
Thank you very much for having me today. My name is Alex Aronson. I'm the Youth Vote Director at the Oregon Bus Project. In that capacity, I run our Building Votes program. It's a voter registration and mobilization program targeting young people, trying to get young people involved in democracy and registered to vote and voting. And I'd like to thank you for holding this hearing today. I think it's an appropriate time for us to be talking about this stuff, both with our imminent voter registration deadline, which is looming tomorrow afternoon, and the election that we have coming around the corner. Also kind of in this epoch of history, we have a generation of young people that is bigger than almost any generation, I think, in American history. I think bigger than the baby boomers. We call them the millennial generation. And these are young people that were born between, there's disputed dates, but 1977 and 1983. And 1993. And this group of young people will be 36% of the U.S. electorate by 2015. So that's over a third of the American voting electorate will be in this millennial generation. So obviously, really, really important for us to think about active ways to engage these people as civic participants. A few things about this generation. They are increasingly tuned in. We have two consecutive elections now with increased youth turnout. That's nationally. And obviously, we've seen, insane levels of youth interest in the 2008 election. Here in Oregon alone, we had 92,000 young people register to vote for the primary alone. Here in Oregon, we had an 18% youth vote share, which was the second highest in the country. I'll talk a little bit about that later. So young people are getting involved in this stuff and they're paying attention like never before. They're also feeling frustrated. For the most part, young people don't trust politicians, they don't like political parties, and they are frustrated with government. A CIRCLE study, CIRCLE is the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. They study youth engagement. They found that only 45% of young people feel like they're taken seriously by politicians. And obviously there's something wrong if that's the case. And we need to talk about ways that we can improve that number. Here in Oregon, we have some unique factors at play and some critical challenges. I think first and foremost, the thing that sets us apart is vote by mail. Vote by mail arguably has increased Oregon's voter turnout. We are consistently in the top 5 overall turnout states in the country. It doesn't serve young people quite as well as it does the overall population. Young people move a lot. 87% of young people are renters, and 73% of renters move every year. If it is mandatory that we receive our ballots in the mail, it is a lot harder when we're moving around all the time. Most of the people that my program registers are re-registrations, updated addresses, change of parties. A lot of young people are getting dropped off the rolls because they are not keeping their registrations current. I think that is, obviously there's a lot of responsibility on an individual's shoulders to get themselves registered, but also I think there's a lot that government can do to improve access to young people to make that easier for them. Now, the problem with vote by mail for young people is the stark reality that young people don't use snail mail. We don't have stamps. We don't go to the post office. this isn't a part of our culture. We do everything on computers. And unless we can start to adapt our systems to, more accurately reflect the lives of people, then we're going to continue to see challenges to get young people engaged. One other thing about vote by mail is that it largely eliminates the sort of rite of passage that we've all experienced with voting. I think about when I was growing up and going with my parents as a little kid to the ballot box and how that kind of resonated with me and how excited I was when I turned 18 to go to the ballot box and close the little curtain and vote. It kind of disappears. And standing in line with the other people that are voting, now it's largely, we're relegated to our our couches, and yeah, we can vote without our clothes on if we want to, but we're losing some of the social bond that exists around this really important kind of social right that we have. Here in Oregon, and I think also across the country, there's a big education problem. We need to be engaging our students more actively while they're in high school around civic issues. The Classroom Law Project, with which I'm sure you're familiar, found that fewer than 46% of Oregon students thought that being involved in state and local government was their responsibility. That's too low. On a standard civics test, Oregon high school seniors who had just finished their American government class averaged a 67%, which is also too low. And so when we get these, two voters pamphlets in the mail that are thick as bricks, it's understandable that we feel a little bit daunted. So I think, in addition to some of the things that I'll talk about later in terms of providing better access, I think we need to think about how we can provide better civic education to our high school students. And then the third piece, I think, is registration access. We're out there on the street with clipboards, and the most common reaction we get is not like, why did you have to stop me today? It's, thank goodness you found me. I didn't know where to find these forms. I didn't know how to get registered. Recent Oregon youth turnout figures show mixed results. The 2004 presidential election saw Oregon saw the biggest overall gap between youth turnout and overall turnout. So we consistently have high overall turnout, and I think it was 77% in 2004, but our youth turnout was only 49%, 28% gap. 49% is actually not that bad among national averages for youth turnout, but compared to the 77% overall turnout, I think it begs the question, if our electorate is so engaged, why aren't our young people equally so? And then in the 2006 midterm primary, and I throw this statistic around sometimes because it's just so staggering, the average age of a voter was 61 years old. 61.
Really old.
Come on, it's not old.
I'm teasing. I'm staring it right in the face.
So this year, and things are changing a little bit. This year, as I mentioned before, in the May primary, we had the second highest youth vote share in the country, which was 18%. So that means that 18% of the overall votes cast were cast by 18 to 29-year-olds. Or sorry, 18 to 24-year-olds. And this is largely, I think, due to the relevance of Oregon's presidential primary. And so that maybe is an extenuating factor, but it's still pretty good. So I think that gives us reason to be optimistic. But I think it's clear also that there's a lot of room for improvement, and we need to address all of these challenges, both educational and systematic. First, I think we need, as I mentioned before, better civic education in public schools. We could do this in a variety of ways. I think, having civic assemblies, civics classes, mock debates, nonpartisan ballot overviews in high schools to make sense of those two giant voter guides that we have in our, couch. I have these two voter guides that I'm still waiting to tackle. But field trips to Salem to meet you guys, I think it would be really valuable to have young people come to this building and connect with you and see, where the connection is between how they're casting ballots and how laws are getting made that actually impact their lives. And second, we need to improve our voter access laws. I think we're not where we need to be for some of the reasons I mentioned before around vote by mail and voter registration access. Fortunately, we are moving in the right direction, in my viewpoint. The 2007 legislature passed two bills that have potential to significantly increase youth access. Senate Bill 951 was an institutionalization bill at colleges, which requires that colleges provide voter registration access to students. I think we need stronger enforcement of this measure, and I also think that we should introduce a similar provision for our high schools, which ties me to House Bill 2910, which allows 17-year-olds to register to vote. And this is great. We've helped, this year already, the Bus Project has helped register over 1,000 high schoolers, whereas in 2006, we could go to high schools, talk to kids about, you know, all this fun stuff, and register 4 or 5 of a class. Now we can register entire high school classes. And what we're finding is that not only does it get them registered to vote, you know, even if they can't vote in November, but it gets them engaged in this process. And now they're volunteering to be, you know, peer leaders, they're registering each other to vote, they're bringing this conversation to the halls of their high schools, and that's great. And then I think also we need to start looking at some of the voter access models that are being used in other states. And I think there's some really wonderful models that exist out there. Same-day registration, we've talked about before, currently allowed in 7 states. These states have 13% higher overall turnout and 18% higher turnout among 18 to 24-year-olds.
Senator Monson. A higher turnout compared to Oregon or higher compared to
the national non-same-day states.
Okay.
So the states with.
So how does it compare to Oregon?
I would have to look.
We have a very high turnout.
It's better than our youth turnout. For the overall turnout, it's comparable. We're in the same ballpark as the same day states in the overall turnout. But when we talk about youth turnout, it's again, you know, we're and I don't know the exact number, but I'm thinking it's between 8 and 12% lower.
Representative Berger. Madam Chair, when you say youth turnout, I'm lost a little bit. And you talked about 36% of the electorate born between 77 and 93, but when you're talking about youth voters, you're talking about 18 to 24-year-olds.
Yeah, and I think, you know,
because there's a
certainly, and I think there's, you know, each statistic that exists out there in the world is from a different kind of universe of voters. And I'm trying to be specific as possible.
But when you say youth voters, you mean 18 to 24.
18 to 24. Some numbers that I'll give you are 18 to 29, but I'll specify if that's the case. At the Bus Project, when we talk about youth voters, we target 18 to 29-year-olds.
Okay, thank you. That helps because I'm...
Yeah, sorry about that.
These numbers aren't connecting.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I can write something up and get it to you as well. With regards to same-day registration, I think clearly there will be some complications that might arise around integration with vote by mail. I think there are ways for us to figure this out. I think if we can, you know, create a hybrid system, we have the chance that we have the opportunity to be, you know, the country's leading voter turnout state. And the other thing I think is same-day registration is great, but it doesn't need to be same day. It could be, you know, 5 days, 7 days before the deadline, before the election. A 21-day voter registration deadline is really early. We're out there in the world right now. My organizers are out talking to students and other young people now, and they're swarming to us because they didn't know that the deadline was coming up. There's not enough access to this information. And then another concern that's thrown out there about same-day registration is voter fraud. Mm-hmm. These concerns are pretty much entirely ungrounded. Here in Oregon, we had this experience with there have been no instances of voter fraud through same-day registration, none. And here in Oregon, we had the Rajneeshi. The Rajneeshi did not register to vote on election day. They registered to vote days before the election, and they were caught. So if you actually do the research, there's literally no voter registration fraud that's happening because of election day registration.
Alex, while we're I know that Minnesota has same-day voter registration, and they have the highest voter registration in the nation, I believe, and they also have the highest turnout. I think both they ranked.
That's correct.
Do you know, are you aware of instances of voter registration fraud in the state of Minnesota?
None.
Okay.
And they're also leading the way with another initiative that I think we should consider, which is automatic voter registration. And this is similar to our motor voter program where we opt into voter registration at the DMV. The only change is that we would be opting out. To do this feasibly in Oregon, we would need to revise our double majority tax rules because we would be flooding the rolls with voters that might not vote, and this would, you know, severely limit the ability of our counties to raise bonds for libraries and schools and things like that. But automatic voter registration is a really impressive voter access measure and one that I think we should seriously consider. And then I think in kind of closing, I think we need to realize that voter registration itself is a significant barrier to voting. And I think we need to accept this and develop sort of creative solutions to lowering this barrier. We have an unprecedented opportunity to engage a hugely significant generation of Oregonians as civic participants. It's clear now that taking strides to engage them, it's clear that they are taking strides to engage in this process, and I think it's up to us to meet them halfway.
And Alex, just so you know, the Senate Rules Committee this morning introduced same-day voter registration as a committee bill.
Woo-hoo!
So, other questions for Alex?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Alex, I just had one question for you because I encountered a problem in Multnomah County with a group of college students who were trying to register and had their residency questioned because they were using their campus address as a registration address. So I'm wondering, in your voter reg efforts, have you encountered any problems like that where people are trying to register away from where their parents live?
Yeah, plenty. There's been a lot of that. I mean, maybe not as widespread as we've seen in other states. I know that, you know, in some of the so-called swing states, we see a lot of challenges made to college students that want to register to vote in the states that they're living. I mean, I think we should be encouraging college students to register to vote in Oregon, to engage in local politics. I mean, they're living in our communities. They're impacted by the laws that we're passing here in Oregon. We try to encourage them to vote in Oregon. And I think some of the challenges that we run into are when, you know, they put kind of confusing information that elections officials kind of grapple with. For instance, they'll put their residence address in, you know, Southwest Portland, and they'll put their mailing address in Kansas. And the elections official, I think, rightly are saying, well, this doesn't quite make sense. So I think usually it's a kind of a misunderstanding or a confusing thing like that. But yeah, I think making clear that college students can and should register in Oregon, I think, is good.
Representative Buckley, and I'll just go down the row.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alex, have you had any experience with people trying to use the online voter registration form, downloading it, sending it in?
Yeah, we provide a link to that through our website. I think, again, you run into a little bit of a disconnect between downloading a form, filling it out, getting a stamp on it, mailing it in. We found that a study was done that showed that those forms produce 66% of the voter registrations that you'll actually have downloaded. Does that make sense? So 66% of the people that download the form will actually turn it in. Mm-hmm. So it works pretty well. Washington just passed online voter registration where you can actually register to vote online. I think obviously that would be difficult for us because of the signature requirement for the ballots, but if we could figure out a way to do it, I'd be for it.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes, thank you. The Help America Vote Act essentially, I mean, it almost requires the same-day registration in that you can be given the option of having a provisional ballot if you ask for it. And if you're shown to be an eligible voter, your vote's counted. So, I mean, you can show up at a polling place, which we don't have anymore, but at a county clerk's office and request a ballot and not have...
If you're not registered to vote?
Right.
Well, I mean, I think that's great. You know, I think that obviously that's good. I think for the most part, you will not have a lot of young people doing that because, A, you know, I don't think that's widely known. I mean, I do this stuff for a living, and I actually didn't know that provision existed. So I think, you know, if I don't know this stuff, then the chances of, you know, swaths of young people actually flocking to their elections office on election day and getting themselves a provisional ballot, which, you know, may or may not be counted ultimately, is pretty low. I think we need to be doing whatever we can to open access to people. And I don't see why we need the 21 days. Why not extend it another 14 and allow thousands more people to vote? It just seems common sense to me.
Follow up.
Representative Thatcher.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not doing the proper response to you guys.
No.
I apologize.
We have to be proper, but you don't. When it comes to, you were talking about education, pretty much, of voters, and that they would not know to ask for a provisional ballot, then how do you expect them, I mean, by the same token, how do you expect them to know when actual deadline is for voter registration, if you want to change it to the same day or even a week ahead of time?
Well, I think that's just the point, is that they won't. But when, you know, on Wednesday of this week, when, you know, Joe anybody, 25-year-old guy, says, oh, wait, I just watched this debate tonight, and now I know who I want to vote for and know that I want to vote, it's going to be too late for them. But if we move the deadline back, then it wouldn't be too late for them. And it's as straightforward as that, I think. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
Representative Thatcher?
One more question.
Sure.
You're talking about the voter's pamphlet, and I wonder if it makes it confusing for people who receive a voter's pamphlet in their mail and they aren't registered to vote yet, or do you think that might lead them to think that they are registered to vote?
I could see that being confusing, sure. I don't know that we should necessarily start sending everybody voters' pamphlets, regardless of whether or not they're registered to vote.
We do.
We do anyways.
We send one to every household, but not necessarily to all registered voters. So you have people who are registered to vote and aren't getting registered.
Yeah, I think that's certainly
the other way around.
Sure, that's confusing.
So it's kind of messed up. So.
Yeah, I could see that being confusing.
Any more questions for Alex? Representative Berger, back again.
Please, Madam Chair, indulge me with a comment. Alex, I'm looking out. You're not seeing what I'm seeing, and I'm seeing that young man over there and you, and the rest of the faces in here are arguably not of your generation. And I have to tell you that the rest of us, our hackles rise when we say that a stamp is a barrier to voting, okay? Voting is a real privilege here, and you trivialize this issue in your generation when you say, oh, they didn't have a stamp, so they couldn't vote. I watched the reaction back here, and so please don't. I have kids in your generation. It isn't about a stamp. Please don't tell me it's about a stamp.
With all due respect, Representative Berger, I'm not trivializing voting. I would not do that.
Okay.
Voting is a habit-forming activity. We know this from research that's been done. And 18-year-olds have never voted before. And you know, they might not be as accustomed as these fine people are to the voting process. And if, you know, the fact of the matter is that we don't have stamps. These aren't, you know, things that we do every day. And voting is not something that we do every day. And I think it's up to government to provide, you know, open access to young people that, you know, want to get involved in this stuff. And I think, you know, obviously, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of responsibility on an individual to get the... a ton of responsibility, but I think to the extent possible, we should make, you know, voting access open to people and try to help people get into this process, because if we can get them when they're 18, we can get them when they're 20, they'll stay voters for life, and we've seen it from research.
I won't belabor it further, Madam Chair.
All right. Anybody else? Thank you. We really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks very much.
Next up, I'm going to bring up both Joanne Bowman and Promise King at the same time, if that's okay. Former Representative Joanne Bowman, I should say.
Just call me, oh, what's her name?
I would never do that. Thanks for joining us. And I also have to apologize. When we scheduled this committee hearing, we didn't really sort of pay attention to when the last day was to register to vote tomorrow. I'm sorry. We've been trying to coordinate Representative Rosenbaum's and my committee. So, anyway, former Representative Bowman, take it away.
Thank you. Good afternoon, committee chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Joanne Bowman, and I live at 1231 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, apartment 535 in Portland, Oregon. I'm here, I have already told you my name. Oregon Action, I'm here representing Oregon Action, whose mission is to develop new leaders among Oregon's underrepresented communities, with an intentional focus on low-income people, people of color, and others who see themselves on the downside of power. Since 2004, Oregon Action has registered over 50,000 voters in Oregon, as well as having 6,500 dues-paying members statewide. Each election season, Oregon Action seeks to identify community members to participate in the civic process of our democracy. Yes, we register voters, but we do so much more. We conduct ballot measure education forums, candidate debates, and/or interviews, and education programs that walk community members through the voting process. Each election season, we notice that there are barriers that prevent low-income community members from fully participating in the election season. Our experience since 2004 confirms that low-income community members understand the stakes of the electoral process and want to fully participate to ensure their voices are heard. Some of the barriers identified by members of our community include the 21-day requirement to be registered in advance of the election. Many low-income people unlike, I'll say, the people in this room, don't spend a lot of time reading political brochures and information up until closely before the election process. And once they feel comfortable enough to participate in the process, as Alex said just a moment ago, it's too late for them to fully have their voice heard. Ballot measures are presented in language that is statute language as compared to common sense language, plain English, information that regular people can read and comprehend. Utilizing the ballot process is not easy, both for youth and, I would say, for low-income people. If you're not, if you don't look at the ballot very carefully, it's very easy to make mistakes on the ballot. It's also very easy to be confused about whether a yes vote really means yes, you like this, or a yes vote means no, that you want nothing to do with this measure. Persons who have a previous felony conviction are not aware that they are eligible to vote the day they are released from prison. Too many people still believe that once they've been convicted of a felony in Oregon, they are unable to vote in this state. Persons are eligible to register and vote if they are currently being held in county jails. Yes, most county jails do not make the voting process eligible for people who are currently incarcerated. Free nonpartisan education opportunities are presented to the public to help them be informed and educated voters. Normally what people get is bombarded with TV ads, radio ads, and information in their mailbox that only tries to tell them to vote one way or another, but does nothing to help them understand the issue and determine what's the best decision for them in their ballot. And finally, the necessity to place a stamp on the ballot is, in fact, a barrier. If you are a low-income mom and the choice is between do you go to the store and buy stamps or do you go to the store and buy milk, I can promise you that low-income moms will buy milk every day of the week. And not only that, people have the best intent of mailing their ballot, but if they don't have a stamp readily available, they'll set it on the counter and they will forget that they wanted to participate in this critical election season. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Sarah Monis Anderson.
Regarding the stamp issue, do you feel there's adequate education regarding the drop sites?
I think that we do a very poor job of educating the public about how they can actually turn their ballots in without drop sites. We spoke with Multnomah County Elections Office because that's the county I do the primary amount of my work in, and they were unwilling to add community-based organizations as drop-off sites. They feel that the sites they have, they publicize them in newspapers where you have to pay money to get. So, again, I don't think that we do an adequate job of letting people know where they can turn them in without a stamp.
Thank you. One of your suggestions is to expand nonpartisan educational opportunities. Any specific suggestions beyond the forums?
Well, in the old days, we used to have on TV, in the old days, I'm telling them myself, we used to have a town hall on TV where we would actually, I forget the guy who used to moderate the program, but every election season, you would have both sides of people on the issue come on the program, and it was an excellent public service for the public because you didn't have to, you know, do a whole lot of research. You could just, you know, watch this information on TV.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I believe that town hall died as a result of federal changes in FCC regulations on how much public information was required, because I inquired about that at one time. But I would also say that there's PEG Access TV, but it's really boring. It has plenty of stuff on it, but on it all the time, but it is really death by.
Excuse me, Representative, you're talking to the president of the board of Portland Community Media.
And a lot of what you're saying applies to all voters, not just those in poverty. And one more point on the stamp issue. At some point, government's going to walk in and put that stamp on that envelope for somebody, and then you have really intruded in people's lives, because that is too much of somebody saying voting's so important, I'm going to tell you how to vote. Do you see what I'm saying? If people want to vote badly enough, I don't believe a stamp is a barrier. That was my point to him, and that's my point to you. But I'm a little worried about people wanting people to vote a certain way badly enough that they provide the stamps to the detriment of all of us. This is my caution.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I absolutely agree with you that it is not our role or place to tell people how to vote, but I think government could do a much better job of actually explaining what the choices are that voters have in front of them.
Before we spend too much time debating the stamp issue, no, I just want to make a comment, and that is we are facing very tough economic times for the state, and this issue on the stamp provided on the ballot has been discussed in my committee, and I assume it's been discussed in Representative Rosenbaum's committee. I think the harsh reality is it's going to be tough to fund that for this next biennium. So, but it's certainly an idea worth exploring at some point. No questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Going back to the stamp issue, only obliquely, there are drop sites. There are official drop sites, and then there are the unofficial drop sites, mm-hmm. and those community organizations mm-hmm. can be unofficial drop sites. People don't want to, you know, take the bus or, you know, drive, walk, whatever, to an official drop site. They can, take the chance, if they feel like it, just to hand it to a neighbor, somebody they know is going, or take it to one of these community organizations and who's accepting ballots and delivering them to the county clerk's office.
That's correct. Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, we, in fact, are unofficial ballot pickuppers, and we will go to people's houses, and they'll call us and tell us that they're disabled and they can't make it out. But that's my point. My point is that there are community-based organizations that are stepping up and providing that resource where, you know, we're doing it because it's the right thing to do to support low-income community members, but hopefully there's a better way that government can be more responsive as well. I mean, you know, if I might add, Madam Chair, you know, maybe we could not put stamps on envelopes that are voting ballots. I mean, they don't look like anything else, and so why do we have to put a stamp on it? The post office knows it's going to the elections office. Couldn't we get a pass on ballots?
Bad idea. All right, we'll put that on the table for discussion. Mr. King, Promise King, welcome. Thanks for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Promise King. I am the Executive Director of Oregon Legal Minority Voters. We are founded on a mission to promote a broader understanding of public policies that impact communities of color all over the state. We have a vision rooted in a passionate belief that we all lose when one segment of our society is ignored, discriminated against, debased, dehumanized, and discredited. So our board came together across race and class and gender and sexual orientation and nationality with a common agenda to remedy unjust policy that potentially could erode and denigrate our greatness as a society. Madam Chair, I probably can't explain how excited I am today because before I begin my testimony this afternoon, I want to say that I cannot see idly by and not give you the gratitude, because there's an African proverb that says that easily we can pay back the a debt of gold, but we die in debt to those who will be kind to us. Madam Chair, you have been kind to me personally as a young LA who came to this building in 99, working for Deborah Kofuri, but you never hide your humanity, your kindness, and your smile for me. I see here today because of that encouragement, and I want to record that. But also, without being pushed to call about partisanship, I also want to express my gratitude to Ferrioli, who took me to John Day, along with Senator Godley, mm-hmm. In trying to build a coalition between rural and urban communities. So, Madam Chair, thank you for your effort. Thank you for having this, and to the rest of the committee, distinguished members, I just want to thank you for making this happen. I come to Salem away from my busy schedule because I feel this is a very, very critical conversation, a dialogue for us to move our state forward. You see, I had a statement that I wrote over the weekend, but before I delve into that, let me tell you the gravity of what we deal with every day. I received a letter last night. Permit me to read that letter. It came from Cliff West. Cliff lives in Rainier, Oregon. He said, "Dear Mr. King, there's a story going around about your organization that says you support illegal residents and non-citizens. From what I gathered, you are in favor of allowing illegal residents and non-citizens to vote. These illegal residents are nothing but criminals. And since they are here illegally, they are entitled to only a swift kick in the behind out of this country. Illegal residents should receive no tax-supported programs of any kind. They should not be allowed to purchase property, receive social security, receive welfare or child health care. Nothing. Why are these illegal residents not being forced to speak, read, and write English? No S spoken here, only English. Your organization, if what I hear is true, is doing our nation a disservice. Madam Chair, rest of the committee, Oregon League of Minority Voters came together across race, I've said, to really look at how we can involve our citizens. I came from West Africa many years ago. I got involved because I felt the world needed democracy. So to receive a letter like this tells you that we have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of work to do in trying to make a process, the gateway to our democratic institution, the registration, the voting, the civic engagement, accessible and free of infringement injustices and unfairness. So what you're doing today, it's really, really fundamental to our moving forward. I'm sending a message that this process that we're about to engage in coming weeks is free for all, whether you're black, white, red, green, or purple. So my organization do not promote illegality. We promote justice. We're justice-bound by our advocacy. So I want to say this message to Cliff West and wherever he lives to understand and clear our name that OLMV stand for what is fair, stand for what is just, and what is germane to our democratic involvement. Having said that, I'm encouraged and excited because this hearing represents a major step towards progress and shift our past indifference to this issue. The issue that confront African-American representation and civic engagement are well documented, researched, and analyzed. They are all on our webpage. But have consistently, what is consistently been absent in many years is the leadership to ensure a sustained progress that every one of us have access and knowledge and education to voting to the ballot. Lack of support of leadership has been our biggest pain. Why? You see that, I remember when Harvard came, we came to this place and asked that there is more outreach, more education, and support of more effort to ensure that those who live in the cocoons of Northeast Portland and those who live in farmhouses have access to education. But again, leadership has been very weakened. I understand the budget constraint, but I am asking you to galvanize your will and willingness to ensure that we listen to different voices that are calling and clamoring for access and for fairness in the process. I don't want to belabor this my vent, But I want to stop now and ask you, hear your questions. I think I will entertain any question you have, because I've heard from my dear friend and the young man that came. And I'm sorry I called you a young man, but...
yes, you are.
So thank you again.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. King, just to be very clear from what you're saying from the email, your group does not register to vote people who are not American citizens, correct?
Yes.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. King.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I also wanted to show you an example of an organization that does an extremely effective job of actually developing plain language information for voters, and it's the League of Women Voters, who every election year does a voter guide. It would be great if we could actually put this in the hands of every single voter, and they would have a much better understanding of what's on the ballot. Thank you.
And Representative Bowman, do they require language be at a certain level? Is that one of the reasons why?
I believe that this is like at a fifth grade level is the maximum that they use.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Shields.
That might be because the legislators write the responses themselves.
No comment. Representative Shields.
No comment.
Thank you both very much. We appreciate you being here. Appreciate you coming down the busy traffic.
No worries.
I just sneeze. Bless you. Excuse me. Is Francisco Lopez here? All right. If not, Janice Thompson, why don't you come on up with Democracy Reform Oregon to talk about national trends.
Good afternoon, Janice Thompson, Democracy from Oregon, formerly the Money and Politics Research Action Project, focused on accountability, accessibility, transparency. One quick comment before I turn to my topic at hand is, if you may already have them on your game plan here, but I think the question about, or the comment about provisional ballots, I don't think it's correct.
John, but if you want to respond.
No. I was just going to identify that I don't think it's correct, but you have better people to answer that question.
We're gonna
bring it. Okay. We got that already planned. So to begin with, kind of being a group that, tries to take a look at research and numbers, just a few bullet items with Oregon statistics. And like in most states, there is what sometimes people call a registration gap, or a difference between those people who are eligible to vote but not registered. And in Oregon, that gap is around 28%, which is about the same as the national average. Now, the turnout figures, as has been discussed, are high, typically top five, or at least top 10, often the top five. So in other words, once people in Oregon register to vote, they do a good job of turning out compared to others. But we're consistent with other states in terms of having about the same percentage of people who just are not registering in the first place. And when you take a look, for example, at last May's pretty high turnout in the as many people think, because of presidential primary, at least on the Democratic side, that was, happening kind of election, 58%. If you kind of calculate that percentage as a percentage of eligible voters, it actually drops down to 42%. So this is, again, just another way to kind of get a handle on the fact that there is this kind of registration gap. As has been discussed earlier, this gap is significant for younger people. We got some data that we put together into a chart that's the last page of your handout. And that, again, is kind of taking a look at eligible voter statistics. Nationally, as we mentioned by other people testifying, registration gaps have been identified in terms of income and race. And it's just that, I haven't been able to track down Oregon-specific information like that, as like the circle group has for Oregon in terms of youth. So that's, some numbers. Let's know what's going on. Turning to kind of national trends or lessons from other states, I think it is important to kind of take a look at the caveats that need to be kept in mind. I mean, fundamentally, there, you know, there's always variation in states in terms of specific procedures, civic engagement. Review of innovations from other states obviously must be particularly considered against the backdrop of Oregon's vote-by-mail system. That said, early voting is becoming a growing trend elsewhere, oftentimes by allowing kind of permanent absentee voting status. And so sometimes you can take a look at, oh, this other state does something, and to get the good comparison, or a more apples-to-apples comparison to Oregon, would be to take a look at how whatever it is plays out for those absentee ballot voters in those other states. Then you have kind of more of an apples-to-apples comparison, whereas you take a look at the voting population as a whole in other states, you get into that apples and oranges comparisons. Likewise, there are a number of things that are really, you know, being pushed by national players, research groups, and whatnot, that don't apply in Oregon. For example, poll worker training is just, you know, hot topic. Making sure there's adequate numbers of voting machines. You know, voter challenge procedures that don't date, you know, folks at the polling places. Those are all, you know, hot topics nationally that don't play out here in Oregon. So those are just, like I say, just some of the caveats to take a look at this. So in terms of facilitating and maintaining voter registration, there's another piece of the National Voter Registration Act, the Motor Voter, that in addition to having this voter registration be an option at DMVs, have it be an option at other state agencies. And there's a recent study that indicates that that many states are not in full compliance with that provision of the NVRA. Now, overall, Oregon's record in this regard has been good. This analysis indicates that it's slipping, but I mean, I have this little laundry list of things that I want to talk to Mr. Limbeck after the election, and this is one of them, because I think that there may be some data issues here. But it certainly has been a topic in other states, you know, North Carolina, Iowa, and Tennessee in particular, sometimes in response to legal action, which, you know, you'd want to try to avoid, have implemented plans that have really meant that they've made significant gains. And those plans typically emphasize training and, you know, gathering, you know, more careful collecting and monitoring of the data. The whole issue of allowing 17-year-olds to vote is definitely comes up in other states. There are nine states that already allow 17-year-olds to vote in the primary if they're going to be 18 by the general election. An earlier testifier mentioned, you know, some adjustments to Oregon law. The phrase I use is that there's kind of pre-registration now an option in Oregon. And that there, you know, this is part of some of the research in this area about, you know, there's ways in which 17-year-olds are more likely to be in high school, more, you know, even if there are needs for civic education and whatnot. They're a little bit more of a captive audience and, you know, can be talked to about, you know, voting and all that kind of stuff. And so this whole notion of voters getting into the habit and instilling that habit early is driving some of the, you know, a lot of an interest in expanding opportunities at that age. Online voter registration has already been mentioned, with Washington State being referred to. Arizona is also doing this. There was some reference to needing to deal with the signature requirement. My understanding, and those states can take a look at this, it's linked up to DMV, where there's also there's already a signature, so that, you know, there's a way to deal with that issue.
And Janice, can I stop you right there?
Yes.
Because one of the things I'm confused about is that Washington, for all intents and purposes, the vote, I mean, they're essentially majority, my understanding, of ballots are cast vote by mail. And so they dealt with this issue through the driver's license signature?
That's my understanding. I know for sure that's how Arizona does it, and Arizona's system, I believe, is in place. And I think Washington's is under development. Maybe, I mean, again, Mr. Lindbeck would probably, may well have more details on the exact status of that. But that was my sense, is that it's dealt with by linking up to DMV records. There's already discussion of election or same-day voter registration. Again, this is one of those topics that needs to be taken a look at in Oregon from the backdrop of having vote by mail. You know, we don't have precinct places for people to, you know, go to on election day. So this means potentially to really, you know, make this, you know, to make it work better, to open voting centers during the vote by mail window and have something that's between, you know, the old precinct places, you know, relatively close to most voters, you know, from that end of the spectrum down to, like, there's, you know, one elections office, you know, to go register or update registration per county, to something in between. And voting centers is, again, another topic of academic and other research. Texas, and Indiana, as I recall, are states that have, you know, been doing, there's a growing number of states that are taking a look at this whole concept of voting centers and something, like I say, between precinct polling places and just one elections office. More and more states, and Oregon is in this group, is taking a look at use of United States Postal Office change of address information to help update voter registrations. This is a common business practice that I can speak to personally. My organization moved about a year ago. You know, I did my due diligence. I tried to think of everybody who I needed to send address updates to, and then talked to the place where I have printing done, and I thought, oh, I don't think I ever sent you an address update. And they said, well, this is what we have for you. Boom, boom, boom. They had it all because I had told the post office. So it's, you know, it's kind of standard business practice because they want their mailings to get delivered to the right customers. So, and this is kind of underway in Oregon with the passage of Senate Bill 1098 earlier this year. Database management, voter database management is another topic. There are some states that have particularly, you know, onerous inactive voter requirements that could be taken a look at. There's a need for precision in terms of voter roll removals or purges. You know, it's a valid part of, you know, keeping the files up to date, but can be a challenge sometimes to identify genuine duplicates and, you know, those people who've moved or are deceased or no longer eligible. And these purging requirements, you know, need to be transparent, occur with public notice. The lists used to evaluate voter roll accuracy, reviewed, you know, for errors, used with carefully designed matching criteria, and, you know, careful oversight, you know, so that the information is available, so if, and there are procedures available for people who have, if they've been erroneously removed, can get back on. Now, again, my understanding is that, you know, this has not been an issue in Oregon. It's another topic on my list for Mr. Lindbeck, but it has been a hot topic in some other states. Sometimes a little, some of the press recently on this has not been particularly accurate. The New York Times last week had a couple of articles that I know, kind of a colleague of mine from North Carolina, it's a group kind of like mine in North Carolina, you know, was very concerned about some of the tone of the time. So it's, you know, lots of things going on. It's a very important topic. And there are definitely, you know, some issues in how some states do things. But, like I say, some of the press need to take a little grain of salt. Now, the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Janice, I'm not really sure what you're talking about. Could you be a little more specific about the media you're talking about? And what was in the New York Times?
So the New York Times last week had an article that mentioned about six states and I'm not going to be able to remember all of them, but I know North Carolina was one because it did elicit this comment. And it just made some pretty, you know, they had done, you know, some reporters had done some analysis of who seemed to be being taken off the voter rolls with some of these updates and raised some questions about the validity of those and some of the other practices. And the reporting just generally wasn't too great. I mean, it was just had some inaccuracies in terms of some of what the states were doing, and I can get you the articles if you want.
No, I'm just, I mean, I was just hoping you could be a little more direct. What were the issues in the article that you...
They probably relate to inappropriate removal of names from lists. And that's, I think, the bottom line.
Okay.
And, I mean, this, like I say, this is a topic of concern. Washington State was sued by the Brennan Center on this point. That I believe, my understanding is that, it got resolved very quickly. Didn't have to, go through all the legal procedures. The Brennan Center just came out. I actually have a copy of it. I'll show it to you if you're interested later on just the whole topic of voter purges.
Okay. Go ahead.
Senator Mata Sanderson.
Just want to follow up on that. Just remind or refresh my memory regarding if a voter has been inactive for how many years, when is their name taken off?
5 years.
Five.
Good. I remember that right.
Yeah. Thank you.
I had people back there I knew could correct me. So, 5 years in Oregon.
Thank you.
Which is, I believe, longer than some other states. So that's why I mentioned in some states people, are taking a look at that.
Representative Shields back again.
Thank you, Madam.
And then, Janice, I'm going to have you kind of wrap up your testimony after
that's
Representative
right.
Shields' question.
Thank you, Madam Kaffir. So is what you're getting at, Janice, that there's been some allegations that certain secretaries of state have been purging certain groups more than others, and that's what happened in Washington, and that's what was suggested was happening in North Carolina? Minorities, people who...
Yes, I think that's the short answer, yes. And it relates to, you're comparing the current rolls with some lists, and I know in Washington State, one of the big issues was too rigorous criteria that were not picking up the nuances of Asian American names, for example, was a big issue in Washington State. So, the Brennan Center for Justice is really working on, a concept of universal registration, including funding to states, because it would be a federal element. Obviously, one reason for this is an interest in facilitating voting, but increasingly another motivation that's coming up is really trying to take a look at administrative difficulties. Right now, we have something that's more, voter-initiated registration, which is kind of a setup for voters who might make mistakes, not notify people about address change, and, therefore you end up with duplicates. And all of that, takes time and resources administratively to fix. And so the thought is to shift gears to, having this be more of a government function, taking a look at existing databases that can be used to add to the voter files and the concept of automatic registration, more of a opt-out instead of an opt-in process. Under this scenario, use of Postal Service update information as a piece of the puzzle and election or same-day registration is also kind of part of the puzzle as more of a safety net, kind of fail-safe. And then the final topic, I think, that comes up in this area is voter motivation in terms of both, people bothering to register and if they are registered, bothering to turn out. And I think, one study used the phrase with, the voters ain't dumb. That if there's no real competitive race, there's not a, tight contest, people are not necessarily as likely to bother. So I mentioned that there's some of the best survey research asking questions of infrequent and non-voters has actually been done down in California. So there's, you know, five items listed as to, you know, what are the barriers. Last month's campaign finance reform was the topic, and one of the top barriers was politics are controlled by special interests, so, you know, that's a piece of the puzzle. But, you know, adequacy of information, getting it out. There was a reference earlier to, you know, we need more, not fewer town halls. And that's a federal issue, but it is possible to clarify and strengthen public interest obligations on the part of broadcast TV and licensing, radio and TV, in terms of their license agreements with the Federal Communications Commission. I don't believe that town halls in Oregon started to disappear because of a ruling, but I'm going to follow with Representative Berger on that, but that's not my understanding of what's happening. It's just shifts in that market. That's a federal issue. As an organization, we actually filed a challenge on the basis of some research and analysis of how poorly local stations cover campaigns, particularly local elections. And actually, Oregon stations were better than lots of stations elsewhere. But it was really intended to be a license challenge to kind of raise the profile of the issue and the need for, you know, more, not less, good coverage of campaigns. Civics education, and then, you know, ways to potentially increase electoral competition. For example, there is good documentation that there's, again, a voter turnout gap between presidential swing states and kind of, you know, non-presidential swing states. And so I also mentioned some opportunities there.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thanks. Excuse me. On page three, you were talking about voter motivation and the survey of infrequent and non-voters. Most of the issues brought up, such as politics controlled by special interests, or I don't feel candidates really speak to me, or it's too hard to sift through all the information, or I'm too busy, or the issues are too confusing, none of those would be addressed by moving the voter registration deadline to Election Day. And I would take it that because it includes non-voters, that they included people who aren't registered in this survey. Can you clarify?
I'd have to double check. Non-voters included, I believe it was a mix of, you know, people who were registered, but just infrequent or not, you know, registered non-voters, as well as people who weren't even registered. But I can double check with you on that. But yeah, this, I think, does speak to the fact that, you know, I don't know if there's any kind of one, you know, magic silver bullet in this whole arena, I know that when they were also, I have to dig it up out of this, but I know that when they people were asked, the whole issue of, you know, when I start to pay attention did come up in the context of coming up with solutions here.
I just noticed that none of those issues would be addressed that I could see by moving the voter registration day to the election day. Am I wrong?
I think, again, though, you can get into, you know, this whole notion of when people are, you know, kind of click in and pay attention. I guess it's, I don't know. Again, I don't think it's an either or.
Thanks. Anybody else? Thank you very much. Appreciate the information. So, Mr. Lindback, would you be available to come up for a couple of questions? And I don't know if you want to bring Ms. Newingham up with you or.
Yes.
Please. Thank you. I appreciate you both being here, and you had the audacity to even wear the same color jackets and dress alike this morning, so I don't know what happened this morning. I handed a letter to you that had a question on it about military ballots and how can we be guaranteed that those votes get counted. There was an issue raised earlier about provisional ballots, and then I just have a question at the end for about voter fraud when folks are concerned about people registered who are not citizens, et cetera. So.
Okay. Before I get into that, I thought that you might be interested in the latest voter registration numbers.
Fabulous.
These are as of 11 o'clock today. I thought you might have an interest in that. You can tell by the bottom of page 2 of your packet, down in the right-hand corner, that we have 174,467 new registrants since wow. January 1 of this year.
Wow.
And we have not hit the deadline yet. I would not be at all surprised to see that number climb above 200,000 by the time that we're done, which means that we will have approximately a 10% increase in voter registration in Oregon this year. And you can, if you look, I'd like to introduce someone to you who is still in the back of the room. I should have her raise her hand. Erica Haas works for the Secretary of State's office, and she is the administrator and our chief technician in charge of our centralized voter registration system. And she helps produce all of these reports. As a result of having a centralized system, we have better information and more immediate access to information on voter registration than ever before.
Can we get you to introduce yourself
oh, sure.
as well? Thanks.
Sorry, I'm John Lindbach, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's
You're
office.
Welcome. Thank you.
So, which question would you like me to answer first?
Why don't you do the military ballots first?
Okay, the question was, I would like to know what assurances you can give me that each and every one of our military who votes by absentee ballot has their vote counted. Well, the military ballots go out no later than 45 days before the election, and the biggest question in the whole subject of military and overseas voting is whether those ballots get to the voter on time and whether or not they have returned it in time for it to get here by the 8 o'clock deadline on election day. Those are the two big questions. And so I can assure you that if they get their ballot and they mail it back and it is returned by 8 p.m., their ballot will be counted. If those two things do not happen, then their ballot would not count.
And Mr. Lindbach, if someone was serving in the military and actually had this happen, in the primary election I talked to a mom who was concerned that her son wasn't getting his ballot, all she does is need to talk to him, and if he hasn't received his ballot by when, somebody should make a phone call, and obviously not everyone can do that, but...
Or they can contact us by email.
Okay.
Our counties are very responsive. Maybe Annette can elaborate on that a
Great.
Little bit.
If I can, Annette Newingham, I'm Lane County's elections official, and we not only have received quite a few back already from those that we've mailed out on the 45th to certainly suggest that a lot of them are getting them on time. But if we receive somebody who didn't get it, we're getting emails all the time. That has changed. If they're a registered voter, they can update their registration. They can fax us the information. They can attach an email with the attachment. There's so much that can be done. And we work, all the county clerks work, with these military voters and other long-term absent voters as well to get them their ballots in time.
Great.
One thing I would add, too, that some of you, I think most of you may be familiar by now with our new alternate format ballot, we call it, that is being that was developed primarily for voters with disabilities to help Oregon meet the requirements of the Help America Vote Act. That alternate format ballot has another benefit, and that it provides an electronic form of the ballot that we can easily email to military and overseas voters, so that question of did their ballot get there on time can be helped by the if they can receive it in an electronic form, and that's been a very positive development.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does the signature work on that ballot?
They still have to print it out. And we have a We have a printed form of the envelope, and it takes a little creative folding and all that kind of thing, and they still place their signatures, and they still have to return it.
Okay.
But we can get it to them faster.
Yeah. Okay.
And those are the two big questions. Getting it to them, especially if they're in a war zone, and their ability to return it.
Other questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did a question on provisional ballots because that's yes. kind of a new concept to me, just in terms of what Representative Thatcher was saying, someone going to a county clerk's office. Can you just describe a little bit
right.
what that process
right.
is there?
Well, the link between HAVA, I think Representative Thatcher was mentioning HAVA and provisional ballots. The Help America Vote Act actually requires states to offer voters a provisional ballot if they show up at their polling place. And they're told that they are not on the rolls or they're not in the poll book, then they have the right to fill out a provisional ballot, and after election day, then the elections officials in that jurisdiction look at the eligibility, try to figure out if it was just a mistake that they weren't in the poll book or not. We offer the same thing. If somebody didn't get their ballot in the mail and they are told that and what is most often the case, and I can confirm this, is they show up at Annette's counter and they say, I didn't get my ballot, and Annette's folks look in the system and they don't see the name, then we are required to offer them the opportunity to vote a provisional ballot, and then after election day we try to figure out whether or not that was a mistake, that they're not in the system. If it is a mistake, then the ballot will count. If there is no mistake, then the provisional ballot does not get counted.
But this is a little different than same-day voter registration because
yes.
the person is actually on the register or believes that he or she is on the registration rolls.
That's correct. It's
okay.
It's slightly different. Sorry.
Go ahead, Representative Buckley.
Quick follow. So if someone, because of they've moved several times, somebody hasn't been able to catch up with their address, would that disqualify them at that point because they're no longer at the address that they originally registered from?
Can I take... I'd like to answer that because there was something that was said earlier that was inaccurate, saying that when people are move, that they're dropped from the rolls. That's not really correct, because in Oregon, we have really three statuses. We have active, which is someone who we're going to send a ballot, someone who's inactive, who's still a registered voter. And if they're a registered voter, active or inactive, and they update their registration, we automatically process that all the way up to Election Day. So we really have same-day registration in effect for the majority of the voters in Oregon. It is only people that are brand new to our state from other states or those that are for the first-time voters ever in Oregon. And we have helped that with the 17-year-olds to be able to get them registered in advance. So it's a very small segment. So they would not be dropped from the rolls. They could update. And we would do that, so that's why we don't have to do provisional. Provisional is more predominant in other states
right.
when they go to the wrong polls, which is what we used to have
right.
when we used to do poll elections. But we don't have the volume as other states because they would just come in, we update their registration, we give them a new ballot for the new address, even though it's past registration deadline.
That is one thing that's been confusing for the national advocacy groups. There are a number of groups out there that have formed, and part of their mission is to get same-day registration in as many states as possible, and they call us. They don't realize that we have that Oregon voters have the right to update their existing registration right up through 8 p.m. on election day. So, and that there are far more updates that come in the closing days than brand new registrants. And so, we're sort of most of the way there. We're not all the way there, but we're most of the way there.
Representative Thatcher, did you have a comment?
Well, a question, because I don't remember that the Act, the Help America Vote Act, actually saying, well, if there was a mistake in registration or if something happened kind of administratively, is which I'm kind of hearing you say, then the provisional ballot is counted. What I remember the Act saying is essentially if you're found to be an eligible voter and haven't, you know, you're not on the roll for whatever reason, that your vote is then counted. Maybe, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember it saying anything about administrative mistakes.
I think we're closer than you think we are. The situation with somebody who has cast a provisional ballot, they have to have been registered, okay, in order to be eligible. That's the case in Oregon. And so if you come in to Lane County and you want to cast your ballot, say I didn't get my ballot in the mail, and that looks in the system and your name isn't there, she is required under HAVA to offer you the opportunity to vote that provisional ballot. Now, it's possible that your name wasn't in there because of some sort of administrative mistake. They've got the card. The card wasn't entered for some reason. Or there was something wrong in which the way your name was entered in the manual entry. I mean, it's possible that you're there, but they just couldn't find you on election day. And if they can find you after election day, and that it was a mistake, that clearly a mistake, that you are a qualified voter and you were registered to vote, then your provisional ballot would count. If they can't determine that you were registered and that you're qualified, then your provisional ballot would not count. It's about determining eligibility that they can't figure out sort of in the sort of press of election day business, that just weren't able to find you.
Okay, maybe it's just a matter of, thank you, I think maybe it's just a matter of the definition of eligible voter. We just heard from Janice Thompson, and we're hearing that, you know, if you count all those in the state who would be eligible to vote, they would be eligible voters, but they aren't registered, versus you're talking about they have to be registered to be eligible. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's... In discussions about voting, you can get into to various phrasing that can get confusing. For example, when you look at voter turnout statistics, there are those in the academic world that look at this and believe that the only legitimate way to look at voter turnout is to compare your actual turnout against on election day to those who would be eligible to vote if everybody was registered. The voting age eligible population. And then there are those that believe that the most accurate way to look at voter turnout is to look at the number of people who voted and compare to those people who were registered. And I think that's the difference. I think that's the difference that we're talking about here with provisional ballots. You have to be registered to vote in order for your ballot to count.
Last question. I received a question from one of the members of the audience who I think is no longer here about, she's calling about voter turnout, and someone at the household says, oh, that's not really a person, that's a cat, or that person is no longer alive. What should volunteers do, or what should folks do when they reach someone or they reach a number that they are concerned that that person is not eligible to be registered and vote in Oregon, or there's circumstances of voter fraud, or that someone has been deceased? What should they do?
They should call 1-866-OR-VOTES. It has to be connected to what they think is the relevant county. Those people at that county will help them. If it happens to be the wrong county, they'll get them to the right county.
Can you say that number one more time?
1-866-OR-VOTES. It's a toll-free call.
And should they have, what information should they have when they call that number?
Well, they need to be able to give us the name of the voter, the address. That'd be a good start. Should they know anything else?
Well, I think that they would need to put maybe possibly something in writing what the information is and what the circumstances are. Just calling something and if the phone number is disconnected is not very firm information. We would investigate in any circumstance, whether it comes to the county clerk or it goes to the Secretary of State's office and they refer it to us, and we would check into that. We've had that in the past. I had someone once as an example where they said they went knocked on the door and there were two people that they said were registered that were not U.S. citizens, and we sent them letters. I challenged it as the county clerk, sent them the letters, and then they provided me their copies of their U.S. passports. So we were able to establish that they were indeed U.S. citizens. So if we take it seriously, we would pursue that. I'd also like to, if I have, can go back to something that was brought up earlier, was about participation in Oregon. In 2004, and I can speak for Lane County, we were 91% turnout. And I happen to have a county administrator, a new one, who came from Minnesota, and he said in a commissioner meeting that Minnesota had the highest turnout in the nation. And I kind of went, really? And so later I looked it up, and then I communicated with him. And Minnesota did have extremely high turnout. It was in the high 60% for a poll, you know, where they do elections at the polls. But Oregon was indeed higher, and I did validate that because I wanted to be sure I was factual, and I shared it with him. And I said, you can be proud of Minnesota, but you can also be proud of our your new state, who happens to have even better registration and turnout. So there you go. I thought I should mention that.
All right. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dueling state staff.
I wanted to compliment you, too. I just recently saw a public service announcement on voter registration that probably had been running for a while, but I hadn't seen it before, that described all the various ways that people can get registered. But I did have a question. I think you might have answered it, but I just wanted to make sure. The fact that people can now update their registration, and we saw a huge incidence of party switching before the primary, and although there were some logistical two-ballot received, but it seemed like the election went smoothly, it would seem to indicate that we could do a same-day voter registration process here in Oregon, although we obviously couldn't mail ballots to everybody if they registered the day before the election, but there would be a way to implement it, it sounds like.
I think it's like a lot of these changes to elections that you can do anything with enough money and enough resources. I think one of the big questions for the county and for the voters in same-day registration would be, you know, that people need to accept the fact that if it's election day under a vote-by-mail system and you still wanted to register to vote under a change in the law, that means you're going to probably have to go down and probably stand in line at the county elections office in order to get it done. You got to be issued a ballot. They got to determine what district you're in.
So it's going to take some time. You have to prepare a ballot. Everything's done one-on-one. But I would also really like to caution the committee to think about the fact that we normally, in vote by mail, would send them a voter notification card, which goes to their registered address. And if they're not really indeed there, it comes back undeliverable, which gives us an opportunity to question the registration. When they come to the counter on that day, you're not going through that process. I probably would recommend that all of those that would be done that way would be provisional, which would be very labor-intensive and would slow the process down. But you'd want to send that notification out to really be sure that you have valid registration, to be sure that the citizens of Oregon were assured that we were doing our job. But there would be a consequence to that. It would be very labor-intensive.
And that's a great point. But I think, you know, anecdotally, and I know I've run into some of these people, there always are people right now who are showing up at the elections offices on election day unaware that we had this cutoff. And so it seems like, you know, it's a question of, are you going to err on the side of a more labor-intensive process where maybe those votes don't get counted until a few days later, but...
People will wait to election day because they always wait to whatever deadline there happens to be.
Not so young people.
Well, that's true. But I think maybe because I'm from a university town, it's something that, you know, it's usually not in the morning, it's usually in the afternoons, and it's definitely the deadlines. So we might be faced with some very long lines.
Representative Rosenbaum, I'd just like to mention to you that this year I've had the honor to serve as president of my national association, the National Association of State Election Directors, and I've also been asked to serve on various committees, such as one through the National Academy of Sciences that is looking at the whole topic of voter registration, and they're doing this under contract with the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission. And I was very interested in the comments here earlier about universal registration and sort of taking a new look at the way we do things. And one of the more interesting discussions we keep getting into in this National Academy of Sciences panel that I'm serving on is, why do we have to continue to do things the way we've always done them? What if we could start all over and completely throw out the idea of how we're doing voter registration in this country now? And if we could throw it all out and start over, what would we do? And I think we're going to see more and more questions about this and this whole idea of universal registration for American citizens. And could there be a way that we fashion a voter registration system in this country that is both accessible to American citizens and also provides assurances to those who are very concerned that there are a lot of non-citizens voting, that only American citizens are voting? Could we accomplish both things? We're sort of staring this big project in the face, which is the November 4th election right now, but I think after the election year, particularly next year in the off year, we're going to see some very interesting sort of big picture discussions take place at places like the National Academy of Sciences, in projects sponsored by folks like the Pew Charitable Trusts, and there's going to be some very interesting work done on this topic.
Thank you. I think the words for that would be secure and hassle-free.
Right.
So, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those of you who've been on this committee longer than I have probably know the answer to this, but occasionally I come across this, particularly this time of year. If somebody, let's say, moves residence from one House district to the other 3 days from now, is it unlawful for them to vote in their old House district? Can they only vote in where they are immediately residing? Or if their ballot gets sent to their old residence, could they vote from that residence?
Well, I could swear you've been part of a county clerk's meeting where these kinds of scenarios are discussed, and some of them are very difficult, and that's obviously one of the more challenging and difficult scenarios. Our first issue that we have to resolve when we're presented with a situation like that is that person is, number one, clearly eligible to vote in Oregon. That's not a question. So they are eligible to cast a ballot. The question is, which district should they be voting in? And one of the issues that comes up is, have they already cast their ballot? Because sometimes it happens that close to the election, isn't it?
That's right.
Our answer when the clerks ask that question is that if they've already cast their ballot, they cast it when they were legally living in that old residence, and that is their ballot that they cast for that election. If they have moved, and they didn't cast a ballot in that old district, and it's they qualify to vote in the new district, and they didn't already vote, then they can cast a ballot in that new district right up through 8 p.m. on election day.
Mm-hmm. Quick follow-up. Representative Shields.
So, but let's say they go back by their old apartment and see that the ballot's there. If they do vote from that old district, is that unlawful for them to do so?
Well, it would call into question their eligibility to vote in certain races on that ballot, because they were certainly qualified to vote for president. They were qualified to vote for the statewide races. If they didn't change Senate district, their Senate, they would be qualified to vote in that Senate race. It would be the House district that would be questionable. And, you know, if somebody challenged that ballot, that would be one of the things that you would be looking at.
Representative Shields.
And then the last one. So what they could go up until Election Day and change their address and
right.
vote up until 8 o'clock
right.
that night, right?
Right.
And I urge them to wait, to not wait until
yeah.
like 5 to 8.
Thank you very much.
Hang on, yeah. Sorry, I've got Representative Thatcher. Are you done,
yeah.
Representative Shields?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just want to clarify something that was mentioned earlier. Is that students are renters, and renters often move every year. Just to make sure, you can, update your registration up through Election Day. Can you?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Montes Anderson.
I actually, when in door knocking in my campaign, have run across a situation where they have had their elderly parents go into group homes or assisted living homes, and all the mail and bills, et cetera, are at their address. But legally, and correct me, they should want the ballot to come to the parents or to the children's house, not to the actual residence, because it just gets too confusing regarding mail getting lost, etc. So have you had that scenario?
I'd be glad to answer that. They could be registered at the nursing home and still have their ballot go to their children's home.
Okay, that's what I wanted to have clear.
And then you also have to, nothing is quite black and white, because if they're temporarily at a, let's say, a nursing home, but they intend to come back, they're certainly entitled to maintain their residence and have their ballot go to another location also. It really depends on where they intend to return to, and they can have a mailing address. So it's important for them to contact the clerk's office to find out what is the best thing to do under their circumstance, because we can really guide them.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both very much. We really appreciate you being here. We have a number of folks who've asked to testify in the audience. And time permitting, we'll move forward on these. I'd like to bring up a panel, if that's acceptable. Ms. Bendel, Ms. Sutton-Velis, and... I'm sorry?
Velez,
sorry. And Linnell Vandermolen. Got it, okay. And if you could spell your names as well, that would be very helpful.
Yeah. My name is Ruth Bendel, B-E-N-D-L. I'm the Republican Party Voter Integrity Chair, and I'd like to be brief. I'm here today because I'm concerned that the main presenters at this informational meeting are seeking to remove identity proof registration requirements, which the majority of the populace regard as voter safeguards. And might I say that with this identity proof, that does require that the staff at the elections office are checking with Social Security, and there's a direct Social Security access number, and or they're checking with DMV. You may not be aware that as early as September, there were close to 12,000 voter registrants in the state who either failed to submit the HAVA, Help America Vote, required identity proof or credentials, or credentials, they did submit credentials that didn't check out. And that number will doubtless have grown significantly by October 14th. So in accordance with HAVA requirements, their votes for federal offices must be excluded from the election count. What many of us don't understand is why the same does not apply to their votes for state and local candidates and issues when they have given ID that simply doesn't check out. I'm told by election officials it's classified as no match ID, but for the regular common guy, that is fake ID that they've given. And we do know that there are places selling Social Security numbers and selling driver license numbers. It's quite a heavy market. So it also bears noting that Oregon's incredibly lax voter registration and eligibility rules were a major contributor to the largest immigration fraud in Oregon history. Testimony at the Robledo immigration fraud trials linked the ease with which illegal immigrants could get a voter ID card without a scrap of identity proof, which is one of the reasons that they came to Oregon. In fact, Oregon was described by coyotes profiting from our abysmal negligence as the destination for fraudulently acquiring identity credentials. Indeed, our national security may well be at risk as a result of ongoing inept policies. What I'm concerned about is when you were talking about provisional ballots, those ballots are regular ballots in a different envelope. And it is my concern with the pressures that exist at the elections office on that last day that those ballots may be treated as regular ballots. I asked my county commissioners if we could have people there at the time that provisional ballots were going to be handled. And I can assure you, and it was after the election, and I can assure you that had I not been sitting at the table reminding the staff, the election board people there, that votes for federal offices must be excluded if those people had not given ID or not given accurate ID, those ballots would have gone through as regular ballots. So there is a lot to be said for getting things in early. And one of the things that I'm hearing here is about same-day registration, the push for same-day registration. We do have a constitutional amendment ever since the Rajneesh issue, which requires that 21-day cutoff. And I think it will be more than for you to get a bill ready. I think you've got to convince the public that there won't be another massive immigration fraud or another Rajneesh issue for us to be facing if you do go to that same-day voter registration. In closing, I urge you to protect the integrity and value of votes from eligible Oregon voters by retaining and requiring strict adherence to proof of identity safeguards in our voter registration rules. And please review what I've attached in the with my testimony that I've provided. Again, those coyotes that were testifying at the Robledo trials were absolutely bragging that this is the destination for getting false identity credentials. So don't let our voting system lend itself to any kind of this activity, and I urge you that you are here to uphold the law, so don't make it easy to facilitate fraud of any kind. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, Chair. Appropriate.
Hi, Chair Brown and committee members. My name is Dee Sutton Velez. You want me to spell the whole thing, or
that'd be great.
Okay, D-E-E. Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N, and Velez, V-E-L-E-Z. An American citizen first, but also a Hispanic, Italian, Irish, of Irish heritage, second. And I think voting here is a privilege of a United States citizen, not a right of criminals who overstay work visas, all in order to use cultural heritage as an excuse to disrespect our Constitution, our laws, but most of all, our cultural American values based on a constitution. This is the United States, and we as citizens have this privilege to vote, and it's a privilege that we have to do, and we go through a process in order to do it. Currently, Oregon is a haven of voter fraud due to the fake IDs given out by our drivers, DMVs, who have entitled illegal aliens to vote illegally in our elections by not checking to see if the Social Security numbers are legal or accurate. For every illegal vote, this cancels out the voice of an American citizen whose vote doesn't count. Not to mention it's against the law, and it puts people into office that may aid and obey criminals. Not only does this is an ethics violation, but it's stealing an identity is a federal crime, and it's also frauding the government. If any of us were to do this, we would be serving time in a federal prison. I don't understand where illegal immigrants think it's a civil right to vote in our elections without being American citizens. These ballots are often in Spanish to accommodate criminals who have no rights to be here, especially if they forge documents in order to work here illegally. And I don't know why state workers encourage this practice and where the credibility is in them wanting to hurry along procedures that can also aid to voter fraud. Also, illegal immigrants certainly have no rights to demean legal Hispanic families who went through a process, who are unfairly stereotyped and discriminated as fence-jumping illegals. We need a system to make sure people who are who they are and that legal Hispanics, like myself, have a voice. I feel that illegals can vote in Mexico. We don't get to vote in Mexico, but they can vote there in their own country. I feel that there's a process they have to go through, and that is learning English. It's jumping through the hoops that anybody else will jump through when they come here, and until they do that, they shouldn't be voting in our elections. OPB put out a wonderful but interesting piece claiming about the illegal Latino community can total up to 30% of the vote. This may work in the Democratic favor in this state, but we're seeing a trend that many Hispanics, once they get acclimated here, tend to be more conservative, like my Puerto Rican family in Florida, and many of the Puerto Ricans there in that state are very conservative due to cultural values, and as they learn and become more educated, they tend to be a tad more on the conservative side. So I think this should be a bipartisan issue. It shouldn't be something that only one party is in favor of, because I think that sometimes things will backfire and it may not happen right away. We need to make sure our state is responsible, one, to preserve the integrity of our votes, and make sure that we are working for not the illegal Latino communities, but to serve the legal American citizens. If you're not honest, then why should any of us our votes be canceled in order to accommodate voter fraud? I think this is a very serious issue. We need to be addressing this, and it's too bad that we haven't done it in the past 4 years. We were making some progress with Real ID. That was wonderful, but we have a lot of work ahead, and I'm hoping that the Oregon legislature will work with us on this to address this huge and growing problem.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, and you can respond if you care to. During 2005, the Election Rules Committee went to, I believe, 7 different communities around the state on this issue. Not a single case of voter fraud was brought forth that can be verified. To imply that a member of any political party in the state is purposely trying to register people who are illegal to vote in the state is an insult to the integrity of each one of us. And I'm going to say that very clearly. I'm a Democrat. I'm proud to be a Democrat. I have never advocated the registration of an illegal voter of any kind. Never will.
I bet if the federal government
imply that we have no integrity, that we don't care about our state, we don't care about our citizens, I think is simply unacceptable.
Well, I think it's really insulting to people to use heritage, cultural heritage, their Latino heritage, and for the people that are here that are Hispanic American citizens to over and over not get a voice in our media, be cut off by OPB and by KATU, and every time we testify we only see that we're all a bunch of racist bigots. And Oregonians for Immigration Reform, and I'm with You Don't Speak For Me, a Hispanic advocacy group who is saying that there is a lot of voter fraud going on. It's being addressed in other states, and I do believe we have it here, too. We were giving out driver's licenses without verifying if the Social Security numbers were real. And the governor of this state actually put a stop to that, but we are still out of compliance with federal law and the Federal ID Act.
Senator Montes Anderson.
I think that it's really important that we made major strides when we passed our voter ID, so that now that at the DMV they are making a correlation with Social Security numbers, valid Social Security numbers. So, yes, we have made progress in addressing that issue.
I'm going to cut you off at this point because we have about 16 minutes left, and you guys have had
a
number of other folks that are wanting to testify. Please come on up. And then I'd also like, I thought there were 3 chairs up. I'd like Mr. Wayne Brady to come on up as well.
Madam Chair, can you hear me? My name's Lanille Vandermol, and I'm on the board of Oregonians for Immigration Reform. I'm at 22262 Southwest Stafford Road in Tualatin. And it should be obvious that the investigations going on right now against ACORN in 12 states indicate that a massive scheme to sway elections using dubious voter registrations is underway. We in Oregon are very vulnerable to similar infiltration if we in any way lower the standards of voter eligibility. We don't require proof of citizenship in order to vote for the first time, nor did we have a state audit of the voter rolls in 2006 when we were supposed to, according to the HAVA Act. Therefore, we're really sitting ducks for activist groups who might be attempting to secure voting rights for people who have no valid ID or government records of lawful presence in the U.S. And so I think it's really essential that we elevate the proof of citizenship to its proper role in establishing voter eligibility. No non-citizen has a right to vote, nor is any citizen really in danger of being barred from voting because they can't find a stamp, or they don't have 42 cents, or because they're used to using computers rather than paper. I'm really amazed at the excuses given to the increased laxity that some activist groups would like to see applied to voter registration. Now, I think that we're going to further dilute the integrity of the vote if we turn to things like automatic opting out, because it just encourages people to misuse the system the same as it would if we move to a same-day registration, because there's no way of telling whether people who want to sign up and vote on the same day are here legally. We don't really check that now. We tend to take people's word for it when they check off that little box that they're a U.S. citizen. But since there's really no checking, and there we have a complaint-driven process, of course you're not going to find lots of voter fraud. If you're not looking for it, you're not going to find it. Now, about 5 years ago, our Secretary of State, Ray Bradbury, stood on the floor of the...
It's actually Bill Bradbury.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, yes.
I think that was a science fiction.
Yes.
He probably loved to have the royalties.
Bill Bradbury stood on the floor of the legislature and argued against a bill that would have made people prove their citizenship for a first-time vote. And that vote actually, that bill failed. So all I can conclude is he's more concerned about getting people to vote than making sure that they're all here legally. And I don't want to see this trend continue, because I know that Ruth Bendel has spent years researching voter fraud in Oregon, and it does exist. Thank you.
And I assume, we're getting the number again, but I'm assuming she's providing those names and that information to the Secretary of State's office. Mr. Brady.
Yes, I'm Wayne Brady. I'm the chairman of the Marion County Republican Party. I live at 3794 East Nanage Circle South in Salem. A lot of specifics have been talked about today. I'm going to make this short, but the main thing is that to preserve our representative republic, we have to make sure that only those qualified to vote, and that the votes are accurately counted. And so whenever you talk about changing election laws, just be careful. It's good to encourage people to vote. We try to do that. But we want to also make sure that people who aren't qualified to vote don't vote. And we also want to make sure the process is tight enough so that all the votes are counted properly. And remember also that often bills are passed and then there are unintended consequences. So you have to.
We hadn't noticed that.
I'm sure you have. But I just wanted to bring that up one more time. Anyway, that's really all I had to say. Thank you.
Thanks. Any questions for this panel?
I just had one. Thank you.
I'm with Senator Rosenbaum.
a little early. I just wanted to ask you or either of you if you wanted to respond, because the idea of people opting out of voter registration, the one that I've heard anyway, is when people apply for a driver's license, that now in Oregon, when you apply for a driver's license, you actually do have to either provide some proof of citizenship or a social security number.
And I
has
spoke
to be
too
matched.
Soon when I mentioned that.
Excuse
I spoke
me.
Too
so,
soon.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, one idea would be to use that process instead of having a separate verification process as the process that we use for verifying somebody's eligibility to vote. So I just was curious what you think the problem would be with having people register to vote at the same time as they're applying for a driver's license. It seems like it would be a more efficient use of taxpayer resources to do the verification then and there instead of separately have people send in a copy of ID and then have to verify it all over again.
Well, I spoke too soon. Now that we have changed the driver's license requirements, it would be less of a problem. But I always kind of wonder about people who can't be motivated to sign up to vote. I mean, maybe they shouldn't be voting if you have to practically do it for them. But in the other case, I'm very concerned about the same day because it doesn't give you time to check that they're here legally.
And I noticed that the director of the bus project was just giddy over the fact that we've increased our voter registration by 10%. But if that was done with whole classes in high schools, where there are plenty of illegal aliens going to school, well, then we've just applied a bunch of illegal alien voters. And I wonder who's going to check to make sure that they're going to be purged from the voter rolls.
I don't think, though, that no one has been registered to vote without going through the process of verification that we use for everybody else. The only thing we changed was that people can now register when they're 17, then they can't vote until they have to still be 18 on election day.
So do you still do no match identification on each applicant for a voter's license?
Yes.
Yeah, right. We use the same process that.
And you can do that all in one day?
Okay. They have provisional ballots. Okay, Representative Thatcher.
Oh, just a quick comment on using the DMV. I think that's a good idea, but you would have to make sure that, just because you're eligible to get a driver's license does not necessarily mean you would be an eligible voter. And right. So you'd have to have some safeguards there.
That's true.
I agree.
That's great. You have the 16-year-old problem then. So, yes. Mr. Brady, did you want to respond?
Yes, I do. I think there is some value in doing it through the DMV, and that there would be more people registered, so there wouldn't be such a need to do same day or something like that, and there would be time to validate it. But you would have to make sure that going through all the hoops that they're actually citizens as well as being a legal resident.
Thank you. Appreciate your comments. Next panel, Bill Parker, Jim Ellison, and we get a third chair up here. Wait, we want the chair. Hugo Schultz. Mr. Parker, why don't you take it away?
My name's Bill Parker, and I have a little different slant on this than these other people that have responded. I moved here from Arizona in February, and the first thing that I did when I moved here was I wanted to register to vote. And when I registered, I was surprised. It was incredibly easy. Now, when I vote in Arizona, I have to present a driver's license to people who have known me for 40 years in order to vote. And that seems a little excessive, but here I understand it's a different process. I was interested, and I'm going to be brief because I know you guys have heard a lot, but I was interested in what Representative Buckley said. In the entire history of this state, there's never been one case of voter fraud.
That wasn't what I said. I say, in terms of this issue, in terms of illegal immigrants voting, we did do hearings throughout the state. We went to five different counties, and not a single county clerk could bring up one incident of illegal alien voting.
Not one incident. Enough said. I'll retire. I'm amazed. That is an amazing record.
Could you stay and respond to any questions if there are any? Thank you.
I will.
Okay. Mr. Ellison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for entertaining my thoughts. First off, before I read what I had, as far as the voter ID based on driver's license, it's my understanding that once somebody's voted, they'll automatically get a new ballot for the next election. And if they registered illegally before Governor Kulongoski signed that new law in January, they'll get a new ballot, even if they registered illegally last time. That's my understanding. The other thing is you say, well, we've got to register to vote the same day. Well, that's very clever. I just got my first part of my voter's pamphlet. I just barely read the cover. It's about that thick. Maybe you got yours. Now, I don't know how anybody, especially if they speak Spanish, well, maybe they get one in Spanish. But anyhow, how are they going to read that on the day of the election and understand what they're voting on? And I'm, waiting for my second part, too. I want to read that one. But anyhow, what I brought is a question posed in an article in Western Business Daily, October 9th, page 810. Is Acorn stealing the election? Mr. Buckley might be interested in this one, at least in other states. Excuse me, Representative Buckley. That's a legitimate question to raise now that the FBI has raided the offices of the Nonprofit Association of Community Organization for Reform, now known as ACORN, in Nevada and North Carolina. Two states where, well, I won't name the names. The group's registration, voter registration fraud is rampant. Rampant. And that's two times for me. And authorities plan nationwide sweep of ACORN offices to collect records. In Nevada, state officials say the fraudulent registrations included forms with the starting lineup of the Dallas Cowboys. Nevada, along with several other key battleground states, requires no ID to vote. In North Carolina, which another lady referred to North Carolina, was, a gentleman did. Anyhow, where Obama had been, never mind the names, or ACORN is registered to record a number of new voters, many of them suspicious. Statewide, Democrats are doing a lot better than GOP in these registrations. In Missouri, one ACORN register named Monica Ray showed up on no less than 8 forms, all bearing her same signature. Suspicious election officials sent letters to some 5,000 ACORN registrants in St. Louis asking the letter recipients to contact them. Fewer than 40 responded. In Kansas City, 15,000 registrations have been questioned, and last year ACORN employees were indicted for fraud. In addition, ACORN officials have also been indicted in Wisconsin and Colorado. Investigations against others are active in Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Tennessee. ACORN has also been registering convicted felons, including inmates in Florida and other battleground states. I don't want to name the name. Besides the fact that, never mind, let's talk about who's the beneficiary of this stuff. For starters, Obama paid ACORN, This person paid ACORN, which has endorsed him for president, $8,000 to register new voter, $800,000 to register new voters. Payments his campaign failed to report accurately. They were disguised in his FEC disclosure as payments to a front group called Citizen Service, and I believe that was referred to earlier by a previous lady here at the microphone. Anyhow, he paid for advance work. Next year, 1993, this person joined the civil rights law firm Davis, Minor, Barnhill, and Gallon, where he sued the state of Illinois on behalf of ACORN to implement the federal motor voter law, which the GOP governor at the time refused to do. Then Governor Jim Edgar argued presciently that the Clinton law would invite voter fraud. But the fraud is widespread and is not isolated. It also turns out some ACORN execs allegedly are involved in $1 million embezzlement to cover up their headquarters. ACORN's corruption is not just out in the field. The pattern of corruption is from the top down. And I didn't read the whole thing. I just highlighted some areas that might be of interest. But I can tell you, I've also followed Ruth around and tried to help her a little bit. But voter fraud is out there. And I think in your heart, you know it. You just probably don't want to do anything about it. And it doesn't make a difference to me. I'm just a citizen. I just hear, I appreciate you listening to my comments. But I got to tell you, you ought to clean this up, because we're leading to anarchy if we don't get the handle on our way we were supposed to run our government. And it's sad to me that so many well-intentioned people I've watched at the Washington County Elections Office, those are wonderful, well-qualified, motivated, just wonderful people. But they're bound by the rules, and the rules are that this stuff can go on. And I think every one of you know it, and I'm sorry I only brought two copies. I went on break and went out and read. I'm supposed to have 25, but I'll share two.
Thank you, Mr. Allison. Mr. Schultz.
Yes, I'm here because I heard about the committee being here, and I was concerned about that there's a general lack of confidence in voting in America, and I found this out by...
Mr. Schultz, I need to identify yourself.
I'm Hugo Schultz.
Thank you.
And, excuse me. And thank you for letting me speak here today. And the reason I'm here, like I said, is I've experienced this when I was canvassing during the primary. People said that, well, I don't vote because, you know, the elections are all rigged, they're all fixed. And this is kind of a lot of the perception, whether it's true or not, I'm not going to get into that, but that, first of all, the machines from the 2000 election, that issue, and now the electronic voting, that's in question. And in Oregon, the mail ballot is in question, because, I mean, it seems like it's so open to fraud. Somebody, young people, saying, okay, mom and dad, don't worry about voting. I'll take care of it and mark it up for you. Just sign it. And especially if they're older and not, you know, not too well. And it could possibly work the other direction. I don't know, but that's my take on it. So, my concern is that I applaud the fact that the governor has increased the requirements for voter registration. My concern is that they just don't be reduced, because if you're going to, you know, basically, if you want to restore confidence in any kind of faith of government, I think you're going to have to make sure that voter registration requirements are maintained. And in closing, I just wanted to, I wish Alex of the Bus Project was still here, because I think he insulted all of us that are over 29 by trying to say that, and I'm going to bring up the stamp issue again, that a young person would rather stand in line the day of the vote than to go into a post office and buy a stamp and put it on. So that's in my conclusion. Thank you.
Questions for this panel?
Just a comment.
I'm waiting for you.
Yes.
One thing, I get a list of my all of my voters, and I go door to door. And true, I would say 40% aren't at home or don't answer their door. But I make contact with a lot of people. And at this point, I mean, if anything comes up, I keep thinking, we talk about voter fraud, but in my walking, where I'm actually going door to door, where these registered people are supposed to be, they all that I've talked to seem legitimate now. About these others that you're talking about, maybe they're out there, but at least I haven't seen them yet. But if I did find one, I would certainly be reporting it to the county.
Well, if I may just interject, hearing an anecdotal story from a college student at the University of Oregon, overhearing a group of other students talking about how they were voting twice, voted at home and voted at school. I don't know if we have a statewide clearing.
Someone was in the 2006, there was a student that was prosecuted for doing that.
Well, thank you. So. Mm-hmm. There you go. You found one.
There you go. But wasn't the illegal alien.
My mother actually also had voted twice, but the county elections had caught it. She was in her 80s, and she had forgotten, and she thought that she hadn't voted, and she got another ballot. But the county actually caught it and said, sorry, you already voted.
Having watched elections there and been a board member at the Washington County Election Office during the last primary, I can only tell you the people of Washington County are at the highest professional standard. It's just they're living by rules that you folks made up.
Well, I just want to remind you that the criteria for being eligible to vote are in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't believe that your county clerks are complying with the Constitution or the law, you should be contacting the Secretary of State.
I just said.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that if you're concerned about voter fraud, Mr. Lindback gave out the number, but if folks are signing ballots that are not theirs, that is also voter fraud as well. And the county clerks are checking every single one of those signatures. So if the signature doesn't match the last signature they have on file, that voter gets a call. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't the actual voter that signed that ballot, they're going to get in trouble. So, and if you have any concerns about your county clerks not following the law, then you call your legislator, you call the Secretary of State's office.
Let me say for the third time, I have the highest regard for the professional standing of the people in Washington County.
Thank you. Representative Thatcher, did you have a comment? Representative Shields, somebody. Oh, Representative Esquivel, sorry, you've been so quiet all afternoon.
Well, you don't look alike.
No, I know. No. You just have been very quiet, so.
Yes, I have been, actually. Thank you, Madam Chair. We had a bill in 2005, I believe, that addressed this problem or potential problem. I believe that we're making a requirement that you had to prove your legal status to be able to register to vote, but that was never carried forward. And I remember on the House floor the words of, we don't have a problem.
No,
well, yeah, we probably don't if we don't have some regulation. I think there's some things that have been said here today that are a little over the line. But on the other hand, I think that you can't tell me of all the ballots that are cast in this state that all of them are legitimate. No one can tell me that. So we had an opportunity, but some of us didn't vote for and support that at the time. So I do want you to know we did address that in the 2005 session.
Thank you all very much for being here today. I have a couple of folks as well, Renee Kimball and Janice Dysinger. Did I get your name right?
Dysinger.
And again, just want to put out the phone number shared earlier, 1-888-1866, Oregon Votes. Ask for the Secretary of State's office. All right. Thank you and welcome. Appreciate you participating this afternoon. Ms. Kimball.
Oh, all right. I was going to let her know. My name is Renee Kimball, and I live in Portland. And I just wanted to quickly address a couple things that were brought up. I thought it was very rude and dismissive of young people and old people to assume that they're too stupid, too ignorant, and too lazy to either figure out how to get a stamp or be able to, you know, follow the rules and do what they're supposed to do. As for the rules being confusing, I'm not the sharpest tack in the box. I've read them. And if I can read them and understand them, it just takes a matter of sitting down and reading them. Some of the people who are here testifying, the woman mentioned that 17-year-olds couldn't vote. Yes, they can. It's in section chapter 248. So it's just one of the things I happen to remember. As far as the percentages that people were throwing out, a lot of statistics, and I really question some of them, especially the one of in 2015, 30% of the voters will be young voters. That means that the vast majority of this room is going to have to be dead by then, because the baby boomers are a large portion of the people out there voting, and we are intending to vote. One of the things I would like to address is the fact that you are intending, or there is rumor that you're intending, to roll back some of the measures to vet the people who are voting. With 160,000 people who have been currently registered new, I know for a fact that the IDs on those people weren't registered, because we've had people from the Ron Paul movement join the bus project, and none of the IDs are checked of any of those people that they are registering. So we know that for a fact. So are the 160,000, is their IDs going to be checked by November 4th? That's kind of an important issue, because we don't really know who those people are. Would you hire someone to work with your heater that you couldn't identify? Would you let someone babysit your kids that you couldn't identify? Would you let them clean your house, work in your car, or even cut your grass? You are considering letting people register to vote and determine how we live and who represents us without clearly knowing who they are. Do you not care there may be thousands of people easily manipulated into voting against you and against the statutes you propose? What could possibly be your motive to not make sure that people who are voting have a vested interest in this country and in this state? These are questions voters are going to be asking when it comes time for them to look at your elections. The voters will take under serious consideration if you are the proper people to protect their interests and their lives by how you handle this issue. And make no bones about it. People are looking at you on this issue. Are you not aware that that a lot of your re-elections are really up for question, because there are any number of movements out there that just want to just kick you all out just because you're incumbents? They don't care. And if you think for one minute that the Ron Paul movement went away when Ron Paul was not nominated, guess again, I was one of the state chairs, and there are tens of thousands of us across the state. We are active, we are sincere, we are dedicated, and we are not working for Obama or McCain. We're looking straight at the state representatives. It's time to start acting like representatives that we hired you to be, and protect the interests of Oregon and the people by making the requirements for registering to vote less stringent. You will be sending a very clear message that our vote really isn't worth much, because you'll just hand it out to anyone who fogs a mirror. Representative Blumenauer's office recently responded to a request for a debate between himself and his opponent, Delia Lopez. And he used these words. This is a quote. Representative Blumenauer doesn't need the people. He has the unions and the environmental groups. We are getting the distinct feeling our legislature is suffering from a severe case of Marie Antoinette syndrome. You know, let them eat cake.
You must protect the sanctity and importance of our vote. You were hired to represent the interests of the people and the state of Oregon. If you insist on devaluing our vote by increasing the laxity for voter registration, there may be unintended consequences you have not considered. Maybe enough of those unknown voters will decide not to vote for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Deisinger.
Hi, I'm Janice Deisinger. And
sorry.
That's fine. And I'd like to you to know that I'm here on behalf of representing myself today, although I am an alternate delegate to the Multnomah County Executive Board, so I want you to know that as well. But I'm here representing myself as a grandma, teaching my grandchildren about voting. And with all that was in the news about voter registration fraud, we were discussing that with my grandchildren. And so we went to the Secretary of State office and pulled up the registration form and we're reading through the rules, and we noted there that you could register to vote without showing ID, but you could only vote for state local and local measures and offices. And so because you can vote without showing ID, that it says that on the website, that leads itself to the fraud and the voter ID becoming just a mockery. Anyway, I had my grandchildren just to see how difficult it was to fill out a voter registration card. They're 10 and 11 years old. They could fill it out without any form. We tore it up. We talked about it. And they said, hey, Grandma, those other people are registered. We could do that. And I said, we teach our children, no, we want to be honest citizens. So we tore everything up that we had filled out. And the people of our state want to trust that only one person is getting one vote. That's just so precious to us, and I just I want to instill in them to be good citizens and to be able to trust our legislators as the protector and guardians of the process of voting. It's just so I wrote out what I felt for you after that. And I'll read that to you now. Voting is a privilege and a responsibility of our country citizen. We must protect that process. An election without integrity is a black mark on a free nation. A corrupt election process discourages its citizens and leads to a corrupt system overall. A meaningful election with the will of its citizens made known is our goal and will ensure a free country. And I noted those words out here on our on the mall around the voter seal, a state seal, excuse me. The voter registration is key to that vote being meaningful. If the voter registration becomes corrupt, it becomes the leavening for a corrupt system. It is the basis from which we work, and we must guard its integrity. Oregon's voter registration card is easier to get than many other types of ID. Our voter registration process has become a tool of those who would seek to steal identities because its lack of real proof of ID, and that is in being able to vote for those state and local offices and measures. Even after the HAVA Act passed, Oregon's voters can still get a voter card without and vote on local and state measures and offices without showing ID. This is outrageous to Oregonians who work hard and play by the rules. To know that our legislators have not protected the process to keep out non-U.S. citizens is shameful. In a time of war, this is unacceptable. Citizens from other countries should not have a say in our election. Residents of other states should vote in their home states and not be allowed to determine Oregon's future. Many Oregonians already think the vote-by-mail elections are corrupted. I've talked to many people who've told me that. One party's motto, vote early and vote often, when we hear that, it's a mocking slogan of corruption to those of us who play by the rules, but no voter fraud is tolerated in a vote-by-mail system. The system should not allow anyone to vote more than once per election. If we want our election to be of any value, we must ensure the voter registration process is at least producing valid ID minimally. Proof of ID is required to purchase cigarettes, beer, and other products. voting is more powerful than these products. It is not difficult or inconvenient, at least for authentic Oregon U.S. citizens. Ideally, the voter registration should match both the Oregon tax records through the Social Security numbers and the DMV records, name, address, and birth date. The ballot should not be sent out to anyone who cannot meet these standards. This would be a better barrier to voter fraud. At the very least, we should join our other countrymen and be HIPAA compliant and for all the state and local offices. Please do not shorten the voter registration deadline. The election offices need the time to process the card. Some barriers to voting are good. They are healthy boundaries for a vibrant nation. And thank you. My name is Lynn.
Questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you participating.
Thank you.
Any other business to come before the committee? Representative Thatcher.
Well, I would just like to say I'm going to be passing out a draft proposal to make sure that all eligible active voters get a copy of the voter's pamphlet in their mailbox. You'd be surprised to know that that is not the case.
Is this a bill for introduction?
Yeah. Well, yeah, for next time. I was thinking it was today, but it's not. So
okay.
It's
all right.
So people can have it ahead of time.
Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess when we talk about elections this close to an election date, you can't help but get a fair amount of politicizing going on in it. And I really do appreciate people coming down here to testify, and I certainly respect your opinions. But I do feel like I need to respond to some of the political sides of what we've heard. You know, a lot of what we heard today is old hat. It's old strategy. It's things from the election year 2000 and 2004, where, as we get close to the election, people put up the specter of voter fraud. And I think what happened in the last two elections is there were these investigations into widespread voter fraud, none of which found any evidence of widespread voter fraud, and many of which were conducted by U.S. attorneys who were under pressure from Republican political figures. So I think I want to put on the record, it comes down to this. Do you want to make it easier for people to vote, or do you want to make it more difficult? Do you want to encourage people to vote or discourage them? Do you see voting as a right or voting as a privilege? And I think that the voter fraud issue is not the real issue. I think the real issue is voter suppression that keeps people from voting. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate those comments, Representative Shields. I also appreciate the committee's patience. We were not scheduled for public testimony today. The focus of the hearing was barriers to voter registration. I appreciate the committee willing to listen to the members of the public that were here today. I felt like it was important that their voices be heard. And that hopefully we all learned a little something. I don't think there's anything else to come before the committee. Committee bills were introduced this morning. Thank you very much. And don't forget, tomorrow's the last day to register to vote, and your ballots will be out soon. And any questions, see your county clerks. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew.
And House committee is adjourned this afternoon.
It's okay.
No.
I understand it's...